Thanks, Laurent. Yeah, yes, the conversation at lunch today was enjoyable and fun. First, I'd like to thank all of you for coming today, and Amanda and the Perimeter Institute, and Christian Bernard Singer, the curator of the Canadian Clay and Glass Gallery, for giving me this opportunity. Believe me, it's a thrill. Second, as an artist, getting lost in an idea or a thought is actually a critical part of my process, but it's not very effective in terms of public presentations. So if I do get lost, I may have to stop and ask you where I was before I left. I can only hope that this doesn't happen, but if it does happen, I hope you'll help me out. Also, as I go along, I will be showing some slides of my work. This is the work that's included in my exhibition at the Canadian Clay and Glass Gallery right across the parking lot here. And so if you're interested in seeing the work in person, I would like to invite you all to go see the show. Please do. Okay, art, science, and myth. I know it's a lot of seemingly unrelated topics to pack into one presentation. And given the loaded nature of words like myth and religion, I do feel that I need to start by talking a bit about what I'm not talking about before I start talking about what I am talking about. I'm not trying to start a new religion. I'm not trying to start a new church. I'm not trying to use science to prove the existence of the divine or even a greater purpose to life in the universe. I'm not trying to describe what human consciousness is or argue that it has any special role as the observer. I'm an artist. I'm not a physicist or a mathematician. I cannot do the math. So although my work is informed by science, it is not science. The work makes no pretenses. My sculptures are art. They are not equations. What I am talking about is this relationship between art, science, and myth. Now, although my work has taken many forms over the years, it has at the bottom always been about this relationship. It has always been based on what I have come to call the mythic potential of science. This is the idea that science will not replace mythology, but will rather inform a new mythology, and that art will play a critical role in this process. So today I want to examine that relationship, the relationship between art, science, and myth, what it has looked like in the past, what it looks like today, and what I believe it will look like in the future. Now, we will need to clarify what I mean by myth, for the words myth and mythology have indeed fallen upon hard times. In fact, superstition, fairy tale, and conspiracy is what most people think of when they hear the words myth or mythology. Science and the scientific process has now described the history of the universe from the Big Bang and the creation of the heavy elements inside the first stars to the formation of our solar system and to the evolution of life on Earth, including us. There is still a great deal to be discovered, and some of what we know to be true now will prove to be false. But this in itself is an incredible human achievement. For those who accept this new scientific description of the world, the old religious descriptions look to be nothing more than simple superstition. Whether it be the strange stories of long dead religions, the blindness of today's religious fundamentalism, or the old spirits that are now being poured into New Age bottles. For these people, myth is nonsense, and dangerous nonsense at that. For those who believe, and I mean truly believe, their religious mythology is not myth at all, but the truth. The actual real history of the world, Myths, on the other hand, are the lies and mistaken beliefs held by other religions, and often scientists. For them, this new scientific description of the world is nothing less than a deliberate attack on their beliefs. My myth is not myth, it's truth. Well, then your truth is nonsense. This not only describes the position of both sides of the current debate, but sadly, it also describes the depth of the current debate. Now, these debates, some of which have been televised, may make for interesting television, but they are simplistic to say the least, and in my mind, based on a complete misunderstanding of what myth is and how it works. So, if myth is not history, fact or truth, if it's not superstition, fairy tales, and nonsense, then what is it? Myth is art. Myth is the picture, the story, the movie of the world that humans create and hold in their mind. And like all art, it's a fiction. Not a fiction that tells the truth, as Picasso put it, but a fiction that tells a truth. Or to quote Sallustus, the 4th-century pagan philosopher, myth is that has never been, but always is. Yes, even pagans had philosophers. Now, in order to understand what I mean by this, we need to take a quick look at how mythology came into being and how it has evolved over time. Now, approximately 60 to 70,000 years ago, something happened in the human mind. We begin to see in the archaeological record evidence of a much higher order of conceptual and abstract thinking. The study of human fossils from this period also showed that after millions of years of evolution, we had finally become us. We were now fully modern human beings, Homo sapiens. And we possessed then the same physical and intellectual capacity as we do today. The best evidence in the archaeological record for this change is the sudden appearance of art and ritual. In fact, we see what can only be described as an explosion of art and ritual. And the most compelling of this evidence is the art and ritual associated with human and Neanderthal burials. Ritualized burials can only mean one thing. We had become sentient beings. We had become aware of our own mortality. This revolutionary evolution in human consciousness must have had a shattering effect. And its impact in human history cannot be overstated. For here is the beginning of much of what we call civilization and culture, to say nothing of neuroses. Up to this point in the whole history of the planet, life had experienced the world as is, a world defined by the material and lived in the moment. And for all the organisms alive today, except one, this is still the case. From this point forward, though, humans would no longer live in a world defined by the material, but by the creative power of the human mind. No longer would we live simply in the moment, but in the past, present, and future, all at the same time. For the first time in the history of the planet, a mind imagined, what if? And out of this question precipitated a whole new world. Now, the environmental pressure exerted by this new world demanded an evolutionary response. And this response came in the form of a new set of tools: art, ritual, and myth. Although these manifest themselves in very different forms, art, ritual, and myth are all basically the same thing. Ritual is performance art, where the performers and the audience each play a role and share an experience. Art itself is a physical representation of the picture of the world created and held in the mind of the artist. An abstract, conceptualized picture of the world that at its best is full of meaning and intent. A mythic picture of the world, a product of mythic thinking. In a word, mythology. This mythic picture of the world does not only exist in the minds of artists, but it has been present in the mind of every human that has ever existed. It is the model of the world that the mind builds from experience to give context to experience. It is the process through which human minds think. This model incorporates all the functions and demands of the body and all the capacities of both the conscious and unconscious mind. It also involves all the seemingly separate modes of thought, imagination, logic, reason, intuition. In fact, after 25 years of making art informed by science, I have come to believe that imagination, reasoning, logic, and intuition are not separate things at all, but are all deeply connected. They are all manifestations of our capacity for abstract and conceptual thought. They are all mythic thinking. Now, the sudden and universal change from a world with no art, ritual, or myth to a world of all art, ritual, and myth everywhere all the time speaks to the critical role mythic thinking played in navigating this new world. For millions of years, human evolution has been driven by our ability to create and use tools. And these new tools would prove to be as important to our survival as the use of fire in the stone point. The power of art, ritual, and myth to organize and motivate the group to action cannot be denied. We can see its power today in movements like nationalism, consumerism, and to a lesser extent, the local hockey team. These first arts, rituals, and myths over many generations coalesced into a model of mythology that was universally adopted and practiced by humans all over the planet. Shamanism. The shamanistic model was informed by the economy of hunting and gathering, the social demands of the tribe, and the mysteries of the local environment. The main features of the shamanistic model were the primacy of the animal realm, the importance of initiation rites, and the role of the shaman. In the shamanistic model, humans were seen as relative newcomers to the animal realm, a realm that often predated them. And all animals possessed power and wisdom that needed to be respected and honored. In fact, in many shamanistic mythologies, humans would not have come into being at all or been able to survive in the world without the aid of friendly animal powers. It was also very important to strike and hold covenants with the animals they shared their world with, especially those animals that were important food sources. Another feature of the shamanistic model was the importance of initiation rites. These rituals were performed for both males and females and marked important transitions like those from child to adult and from adult to elder. These rituals were usually designed and controlled by societies within the tribe. The social function of these rituals was to make these transitions as smooth as possible. Living so close to the edge, hunters and gatherers had little time for teenage angst or a midlife crisis. Although these rituals had important social functions, they were primarily designed to facilitate for the individual a personal experience with the divine. This experience was his or hers alone, and the legitimacy of this experience and the personal nature of that relationship with the divine was accepted by the tribe. As the name suggests, the shaman held a significant place in this model. The role of the shaman was to intercede in the spirit world on behalf of the tribe. Now, this may seem a little silly to us now, but having a powerful shaman deal with the terrors that haunted their collective unconscious was important. It freed up the other members of the group psychologically, allowing them to focus on the daily business of survival. This model of mythology was universally practiced by hunter-gatherer societies everywhere and existed intact in remote areas of the planet where agriculture was not possible right up into the last century. And by legitimate, I mean traditional shamans in indigenous societies, can still be found practicing their arts today. Now, approximately 12,000 years ago, we see the first evidence of agriculture and the domestication of animals. The domestication of the dog had come much earlier than this, but I did not want to include the dog because the jury's still out as to whether the dog domesticated us or we domesticated the dog. And over thousands of years, we see the emergence of the first city-states. This revolution in science, and I'll probably do a lot of this from now on, and the technology and the increasing complexity of the social order demanded a revolutionary change in their mythology. Out of this ferment emerged a new model of mythology. The religious institution and their functionaries, the priests. Now, the job of the priest is very different from that of the shaman. A priest's job is to perform the prescribed ritual reenactments of events in the history, mythology, of the state. As part of the ruling elite of a complex society, the main goal here was not to facilitate a personal experience of the divine, but to inform the individual as to their place in the society. The intent was to generate a sense of belonging to the state, and through the state, to the divine. At the same time, the arts of writing, astronomy, mathematics, and geometry all come into being. These new arts, sciences, all fell within the domain of the priests, and together they created a new and very powerful way of describing the world. This new description was especially informed by the arts, sciences, of astronomy and geometry. This is evidenced by the sudden increase in geometric art in the archaeological record. The most telling of this art is the perfectly geometrically balanced mandala, a circle with the sun king at the center, accompanied by the moon queen, and orbited by the attendant planet priests and court. Now, designing your society based on the hierarchy of the heavens may again seem silly to us today, but by appropriating the natural hierarchy of the heavens, they gave legitimacy to the manufactured hierarchy of the state. So it is here that the gods, who for the most part lived on or in the earth, leave the planet. And from now on, it would be on earth as it is in heaven. This religious model of mythology spread across the planet with the spread of agriculture and quickly became the dominant model. And as we all know, is still with us today. What this short history reveals is that over the course of human history, there have been two dominant models of mythology, shamanism and religion. The transition from shamanism to religion also suggests that given a significant enough change in the socio-economic order and the accompanying revolution in the arts, sciences, and technology of the time, even the most dominant model of mythology, like shamanism, a model that had existed for 50,000 years, can be rendered obsolete and abandoned. Although science has, in its turn, rendered the religious model of mythology obsolete, this model was not created, as many believe, out of ignorance, but was based on the best understanding of the world at the time. Now, the idea that the Earth is a flat, stationary disk orbited by the sun and the planets and stars may no longer be believable, but it once was, and in the stomach, it still is. We can also see that even though models can be abandoned, mythology remains. So we need to look past the models to see what myth itself is and see that it is a very much a universal human constant. Now, with all the craziness spawned by traditional religious mythology, it's easy to understand why many would rather live a life of logic and reason free of myth. The problem is you can't, and we won't. Again, the mythic picture of the world you hold in your mind is not something that can be jettisoned, but is deeply embedded, a deeply embedded part of the conceptual and abstract thinking, suggesting that humans can simply stop building mythic models of the world in their mind is like suggesting we should just give up dreaming in our sleep. It just simply won't happen. It is also important to recognize that though all religion is myth, not all myth is religion. In fact, today a whole new industry and machine has come into being that is mass-producing myth with great efficiency and effect. The problem is these new soundbite myths are being informed by political and economic agendas. They are designed to brand loyalty, frame the issues, and control the conversation. A mythology informed by such things will only strengthen the cultural and economic boundaries we now need to escape. If you want to see what this looks like, just watch your TV. I suggest Fox News. The only real choice now is not whether we will or will not have mythology, but what will that mythology be informed by? What will it look like? What will your mythic picture of the world, your sense of place and belonging, be informed? Will it be informed by your choice of software, tableware, or outerwear? Your politics left, right, or center? Or will it be informed by something more encompassing? May I say something more universal? We are now experiencing a scientific and technological revolution that, like the agricultural revolution 12,000 years ago, is demanding a revolutionary change in our mythology. I know, a lot of revolutions, my head spins too. But today we live in a world no longer defined by the economic and social demands of isolated city-states, but by globalization and the internet. Science and technology have also completely overturned our understanding of what the world is and how it works. We are no longer the whimsy of the supreme being, but the natural product of the Big Bang, an expanding universe, and evolution. Although this new scientific understanding of the world has made traditional religious beliefs obsolete, it will not in itself become the new religion. In fact, the religious model, with its hierarchy, institutions, bureaucracy, and unassailable dogma, has, I believe, had its day and will not be replaced by the same. With the rise of the power of the individual and the collapse of institutions everywhere, the center for the generation and holding of myth has now shifted from the institution to the individual. This makes the rise of another highly bureaucratic, dogmatic model like religion, at least for the short term, let's say 1,000 or so years, highly unlikely. Each individual is now free to create and hold his or her own mythic picture of the world. This new freedom does not, however, come without its responsibilities. For without a dogma or a bureaucracy to guide what you choose to inform your mythic picture, what you choose to inform your mythic picture by becomes critical. Now, if you accept the idea that myth is based not on our ignorance, but on our understanding of the world, then science is the obvious choice today. For today, our understanding of the world is scientific. Science is not only the obvious choice, but in my mind, the best choice. As a universal, open-ended, and evidence-based process, it is less likely to be divisive or captured by dogma. And any mythology informed by science would, by its very nature, become what I call an evidence-based mythology. An evidence-based mythology informed by science will have distinct advantages over both the shamanistic and religious models. We now have a creation story, not of a specific people at a specific place or time, but of the universe. This scientific creation story puts an end to the idea that any one place or people are any more the center of creation than any other. Now, given the destructive power that science has bestowed upon us, and the horrors that are only possible after you demonize the other, this is significant. A creation story informed by science, the sciences of physics, cosmology, and evolution, and the economic and social demands of a single people sharing a single planet, there can be no them and us anymore. There is just us now. It will also have the advantage of not only being true as anything can be, but as full of wonder and belonging as anything we could make up. Yes, we will have to give up the comforts of a personal God, for there simply is no evidence of one. But the universe does not need a divinity to be divine, or miracles to be miraculous. It just is. And yes, even an evidence-based mythology informed by science will spawn its share of shallow, crazy, and even dangerous ideas. This, however, is true of all things human. Art is dangerous. Politics is dangerous. And science itself has become extremely dangerous. It must also be said that the track record for logic and reason is no better. The scientists of North Korea, a nation that has banished mythology for the logic and reason of international communism, have constructed the bomb for the great leader. And now it seems a rocket to stick it on. Sadly, this is the nature of human beings. Anyone who is waiting for a new mythology or a new age of reason to end the craziness will, I'm afraid, be disappointed. Now, a great many scientists I talk to are uncomfortable with the idea that science will be translated into mythology. They maintain that science and math are mutually exclusive and have no connection whatsoever. Many insist that the mathematics is untranslatable and cannot be used to create a true picture of the world. This may indeed be the case, but just because the math cannot be translated does not mean it will not be translated. Science, especially physics, have become so complex and counterintuitive that the mathematics can only be grasped by a very small and highly specialized intellectual elite. You guys. So how do the rest of us, who could not do the math, almost all of us, assimilate this information into our lives? Physicists themselves have started this process, for although many physicists hold the position that the math cannot be translated, many attempt to do exactly that through books, pictures, and Nova specials, they create mythic images that describe the real-world implications of the mathematics. Yes, these translations are imperfect, or what I like to call approximations, but this does not make them any less important. No one can argue that we would all be better off left in the dark. In order for science and society to move forward at this point in our history, it's imperative that the public at large be engaged. We now live in a world that is dominated by science and technology. In order for us to deal with this new reality, we need to know. Conversely, a very large percentage of the general public seems to have no interest in science at all. When questioned as to why this is, they almost always say the same thing. They just don't see what it has to do with their day-to-day lives. For all those I meet who express this opinion, I always have the same response. If you believe in your cell phone, you believe in quantum mechanics. The job of translation will not be left solely to scientists, but will be taken up by those who always have: artists, painters, sculptors, playwrights, poets will all do what they've been doing for 70,000 years. They'll translate. This partnership between science and art will create the images and stories through which the mathematics will be translated into myth. Now, the mathematics of string theory may indeed be pure logic and reason, but the picture of tiny strings playing the music that creates the universe is pure mythology. Now, interesting enough, science is now suggesting that it will not only be able to describe how the universe works, but why it exists at all. Historically, this why question, the big question, has been left to religion, but that seems to be changing. Upon first hearing this, I immediately thought of Douglas Adams, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. when this, in this book, the pan-dimensional beings of the planet Macrothea build Deep Thought, the greatest computer ever constructed to calculate the answer to life, the universe, and everything. After waiting 7.5 million years, they gathered to receive the answer. Deep Thought informs them that she has indeed figured out the answer, but warns them that they're not going to like it. But they need the answer, they demand the answer. So Deep Thought gives it to them. 42. It may be, at some point in the future, mathematics will answer the why question, but it will not be expressed as a number or an equation, but as art, as a story, as myth. The math will, by necessity, become mythology. If we ever do reach the point where we can all accept an equation as an answer and not automatically create that mythic picture in our minds, then we are no longer Homo sapiens. We will have evolved into something else. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the audience?
That was absolutely wonderful context for your work, John. I was wondering if you could also talk up maybe a little bit in this particular piece about your artistic process for creating your work.
Well, as I said, getting lost is part of it. What I'm trying to do is create mythic symbols that talk about scientific discovery and reality. The universe that science is showing us today. Like this piece, which is called Flying, obviously it's a visual representation of a galaxy. But my galaxies aren't made out of stars, they're made out of feathers. Now, we all know what a feather is. Feathers are beautiful, but feathers are made for flying. So we all understand flying on that level. What we don't understand, or what we don't understand intuitively, is that we're flying at thousands of kilometers per second as we speak. And not only are we flying at thousands of kilometers per second, but everything around us is on fire. And the stomach still does believe that the world is flat, and that we're standing still. So what I'm trying to do is take a symbol, the feather, or an object, the feather, that we all understand is flying, and build a galaxy out of that, so that we can all transfer that sort of intuitive understanding of flying to the fact that, you know, in the 40 minutes we've been here, we're now thousands of kilometers away from where we were when we started. Yeah. Well, I'm really open to what anybody sees. I have a conceptual basis for my work, but I don't like write a statement about what people need to see in the pieces. And people see whatever they need to see in the pieces. I'm okay with that.
Other questions? I have one, in fact. At lunch, you mentioned that you have a representation of particle wave duality. Can you talk about this?
Do we have the clicker? Yeah.
Or did you ever work about particle wave
duality? It's the amber one, the width. That's it.
Maybe you can say to the audience, what's particle wave?
There was a sort of a very important experiment done sort of beginning of the last century where it was shown that light is both a particle and a wave. And really this is an iconic discovery and and a big part in the development of quantum mechanics, this idea that particles are point particles and waves. So again, I take a wave, we understand, and a particle, we understand, and I put the two together. So you can see the particles at the top, and you can see the waves at the bottom. So again, it's just a very straightforward visual representation of that scientific idea.
Other questions?
Yeah, part of working with glass is my history. I learned how to make blow glass. That's part is just simple history. The reason for continuing to use the material is it contains an energy that no other material has. It vibrates. Okay? Part of that energy is the shadows it casts and the information you can gain by that. All my work always sort of tends to be hung up against a wall, and the shadows become a very important part of the piece. But I think really it is the energy of the material. You can see it vibrating. As far as the process, people ask me what I do in the studio all day, and I say, well, I go in, and I pick up a little piece of glass on the table and I put it over here. And then I look at it all day. And then before I go home, I pick it up and I put it back. And because really the biggest part of the process is what's going on in my head, you know. And Ryan and I had, in our discussion this afternoon at lunch, talked about that. It doesn't happen all the time, and for those who've experienced it, doesn't happen enough. But sometimes when you're just there with the piece and you're so deeply involved in what it is, and physically and emotionally and intellectually involved with the piece, sort of you enter this kind of space. And Laurent called it clarity, where you just go, oh yeah, why didn't I think of that before? Or yeah, that's how it's supposed to be. And like I say, it doesn't happen all the time, but when it happens, that's when the pieces really become themselves. And it's great when it happens, and Ron was telling me that he has the same experiences when he's working with equations. And I wish it would happen more. But as I gain experience with that, I'm also able to see that in other people's work. And I'm getting to the point where I can see a piece by another artist and go, yeah, they were there, you know. They were in that place, you know. That's why this piece is here. That's why this piece is as good as it is. So for me, it's a constant striving to get to that. And that's where the things really start to happen. That's when the ideas and the piece really come.
Is that better? Yeah, there we go. So I had this conversation with a cosmologist who was sitting next to me at lunch, and he was explaining new discoveries about the beginnings of the world, which, you know, are just so phenomenal. And I said, well, when you're discovering these things and you're working out your math and you're looking at it from, in order to move to the next step and develop the idea further, don't you kind of have to sort of look at it from the side and maybe from below and above and maybe flip it over and look at it from another angle, and in order to sort of see it anew and then have that propel you to the next step? And so in that conversation, we were talking about how artists do that naturally, that in order to, it's never a situation of a sort of a linear series of manifestations. It's always messy in a way, but in a good way.
Yeah. That's what happens in that space when you get there. It's kind of like you see the piece from all angles, or you see, it's hard to explain. Like Laurent used the word clarity, and that's really what it is. It just becomes clear. And when that happens, that's when pieces happen. And that's kind of, you know, I'm that clarity junkie, I guess, you know. It's like, you know, I'm always trying to get into that space where that happens. You know, people, I often don't like talking about the pieces themselves, because people ask questions like, how long did that take you to make? And my pat answer for that now is 30 years. You know, I worked 30 years and now I can make that. You know, so I think that's sort of what you're talking.
I was curious when you talked about the energy of glass as a material. Do you find that there's also a different kind of energy? For instance, your pieces here in the kind of the gold color as opposed to the red, as opposed to the clear, and if you could speak about that a little.
Well, color carries content. You know, if you see my work, it's usually one or two colors at the most, because I'm very selective of what colors I use in a piece, because I know that color carries a message. You know, dark red is blood, you know, and green is growth and life. And so when I make a piece, I'm very careful about what color goes into that piece, and I tend to like strip a lot of stuff away. That's why I end up with kind of this minimal color palette, because the color of the piece has a big part of the message of the piece. There's, you know, when you see gold, you see a certain, there's a certain connection in terms of memories or culture that automatically happens. You may not be conscious of it, but it automatically happens. So when it comes to color, I'm very careful.
Okay.
What's the scale? Like, that. Are these one size or?
No. That piece is 12 feet long. Yeah. So my pieces tend to get big, but that's because I make pieces out of parts. So I when I go into the studio, you know, I've sort of thought, I've got this idea in my head of what the piece is going to be about and what the element I need to make that piece, you know, whether it be a feather or a wave. And I go into the studio and I do a lot of experimentation to try and figure out, okay, is that what it's going to look like, or is, you know, does this work? And but when I come out of the studio, I usually have a large number of parts. And then I start putting them together. So This piece is about 12 feet long. The white feather galaxy you saw earlier is about 5 feet in diameter. So, but I think that's, like many people go into the studio and they make a piece, and the piece is whatever they can handle in their hands at the time or in the studio. I make elements, and then I make pieces out of the elements. So it's kind of a two-step process. I do three-dimensional pieces. I have one in the show. I have I don't know if we have the image, the black hole piece that draws. This piece here. So that metal funnel is about 12 feet high. And it's a lot of people recognize it. It's kind of modeled after that iconic graphic image of a black hole, a singularity, and you know, the warping of space down to a point. And this piece is kinetic, so it's blown around by fans. And the there's, when you try and fit relativity, gravity with quantum mechanics, there's this thing happens where the equations tend to come out nonsense, or what's called infinities. And so my black hole blows around sort of in a random manner. Can we see the next slide? And draws equations in the sand that are nonsensical. So the infinite number of monkeys, given the infinite number of time, will, write the Bible. Well, given an infinite amount of time, maybe it will write an equation. Whether we will be able to read it or not, I don't know. Okay, but it sort of floats around in a very sort of poetic manner, and it does cast shadows, and does it operates. It does all kinds of things. So I do simply hang. And I also, I don't always work with glass. I do work with other materials.
Do you ever get people looking at your art in a different way that you didn't think that they would think of?
Never ceases to amaze me. Like I say, it's, you made it. It's your baby, And you do have that kind of feeling towards it. But the other reality is once you've made it, it's really no longer yours. And as soon as you put it in a gallery, it's not yours at all anymore. Like, it's kind of gone. And, I can't say that I really appreciate all the interpretations people have given me. and it's funny when you see somebody who creates this totally logical, reasoned argument as to why this thing is this, and you look at them and you think, oh my God, what an imagination. But I'm open to that. It's the only way to avoid that happening is hide all the pieces in the basement, So you put them out there and people see what they want to see. And some people, and sometimes, if somebody insists that they're going to talk to me about it, sometimes I try to explain to them what it really is. And it just simply doesn't work. It's mythology, right? Once you get that picture in your mind, that's your world. And everybody's got their own picture. And when they look at my work, they're fitting my work into their picture. So they're going to see it, they're going to see it the way they're going to see it, which is fine. That's good. I really do not tend to talk about each specific piece because I don't want to tell people what they're supposed to see in the piece, right? And I don't write little descriptions on the wall in the show. This piece is about, birds and galaxies. You know, I don't do that either. So did any of it make sense? I put a title on the piece, and that is a hint. Yes, you caught me. But that's just a hint, and I try and make it just a hint. You know, so. Making art is fun. That's why I do it. That's really what it comes down to. Like all the other stuff, you know, the theories and the concepts and, you know, all this stuff, I think, you know, all this stuff that's going on in my mind when I'm making work, you know, and people ask me what it's about, and you can see their eyes glaze over after a couple of minutes, you know. But really what it comes down to is it's fun. It's enjoyable. And at this point, I just have to do it. If I don't make work, I get really buggy. It's an addiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for this wonderful talk and this conclusion, which reminds me of a quote by Feynman that says about science, that says that you know, science might have some practical consequences. Science is like sex; it might have some practical consequences, but that's not why we do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Richard Feynman was quite a character. And an inspiration. Thank you.